Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney. That's all you're getting. No, my name is Whitney Seibold. I am a critic. You can call me just Whitney on the street, though. That's okay.
Whitney on the street would also like you to call him Rockmeister McCool in all of the correspondence here at We've Got Mail. Here's how this podcast works. Our listeners send us emails.
You write his letters? We read them. That's how it works.
Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. box for those who prefer to send snail mail. Whitney, what is the P.O. box? Because I can never remember.
It's Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
We missed last week, so we're going to jump in even faster than usual. Mm. Whitney, what is our first email?
Our first letter comes from Pedro. Hello, Pedro.
Hi, Pedro.
Hey, Bibbs and Rockmeister, greetings from Sao Paulo.
Ooh, cool.
Greetings. My question is simple. Are movie titles important? Hmm. I know it serves a purpose for cataloging and identification of films, but I have a few thoughts. As a Brazilian who consumes a lot of movie podcasting from the United States, the first thing I always have to do when searching your recommendations is find out what the movie title is in Brazil.
Hmm.
Most of the time, they're really different. Sometimes I find the translation to be better. Most times, I prefer the original. Sometimes, the impact of the title is completely lost in translation when released here. So people go to movies based on, is it a part of a franchise or based on some IP, the cast, maybe the director, the synopsis, or a trailer, and all and I find all these things are more important than the titles. I'll give you some examples. Trying to translate the title into Portuguese to English made my point clear. These are a few movies I've seen lately. The movie Vertigo translates to A Body That Falls.
Okay.
In Portuguese.
I like it. Yeah. Poetry.
Lucky Number 11 translates to Checkmate.
Okay.
The Game, David Fincher film, I'm assuming, translates to Lives in Danger.
Okay.
Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar translates to Two Ants on Vacation. The Half of It translates to You Wouldn't Imagine.
Okay.
You wouldn't imagine. That one's
a little generic.
Those are both a little vague. Amsterdammed translates to Chase on the Death Canal.
Ooh, I like that. That's better, yeah.
And Big Trouble in Little China translates to The Adventures of the Forbidden Neighborhood. Those are both cute.
Those are fun.
Just to complete the list, I'll bring up some English translations of Brazilian films. Close to the point, also check them out if you can because they're great. The classic Brazilian documentary 20 Years Later was originally called Man Marked to Death. The LGBTQ coming-of-age film The Way He Looks is originally called Today I Want to Go Back... I Want to Go Alone Back Home.
Today I Want to Go Alone Back Home.
Yes.
Okay.
The Brazilian New Wave classic Antonio das Mortas, I love that the American title is in Portuguese, was originally called The Dragon of Evil versus the Saint Warrior.
Ooh.
Which is incredibly evocative.
That's a great title. Holy, I'll watch that. I'll watch any movie with that title. That's an amazing title.
So what do you think is the importance of titles if they lose their meanings in translation around the world? Mm. Is it just a cataloging attribute? The problem is why I would never be able to pay attention in the Schmodown. Also because I don't know half as much as the players.
Okay.
Since when I already know the answer, it's probably the Brazilian title. Love you guys, Pedro.
That's actually a really good question. Movies, oftentimes, they start off with one title in the screenplay phase, and then they go through different titles, or they workshop titles, often if it's a studio project. What did they famously, there was like one executive wanted to change the title of Back to the Future to like Spaceman from Pluto?
Something like that.
Yeah, and there's like this memo you can find of them like trying, like, no, seriously, we could change the title. Mm. And it'll be so much better than Back to the Future. Let me explain how this works. And
well, we're getting lost in the weeds of when we find a film we like, we cease becoming imaginative about improving it. It's like this, it's fine the way it is. Don't change anything about it. It's fine. Not realizing that maybe there is a better title out there than Back to the Future. Maybe it would have made an even bigger impact if it had a different title.
I don't know. Back to the Future is about as big as movies could get. I
know,
think,
but
like,
but imagine it bigger.
Yeah. Well, and here's another one. The opposite example, Avengers Endgame is one of, if not the biggest movies of all time. I think maybe Avatar overtook it because it got re-released, but it's like made enough money to make Solomon blush, to quote Eddie Izzard. And Endgame is a shitty title.
Yeah.
Endgame is anything.
It's really generic. Yeah.
Infinity War has some poetry to it. Endgame is nothing. I was really disappointed when it was called Endgame. I was like, oh, that's a bad title. That's not evocative. That doesn't excite me. I feel like titles... One, yes, you do need to name your movie something, so people know what to call it. But I feel like, and this is one of the reasons why titles often change in different markets, it's because different titles will have different impacts. Like, you could literally translate a title, but oftentimes that title is a reference to something or has a play on words, like a pun. Mm. That's like not going to necessarily translate to every language.
Yeah, you mentioned Amsterdammed. That's a pun in English.
Yeah.
But
it's not necessarily going to fit. Like, you could take the word for Amsterdam and the word for damned, and they're not going to sound anything like each other in another country. So even if you have the literal title translation, it's not going to have that impact. Also, I don't think it's a great title anyway. But I think a title should represent what the movie is to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't hear the title and then see the movie and then feel like you got screwed because the title suggested something you weren't going to get.
Yeah,
I think that's important. So on one level, it is to an extent sort of labeling and advertising, but I think a good title, like a really good title, can excite you. Like, ooh, what? Like Back to the Future is dynamic.
Well, it should at the very least be kind of descriptive.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of bad titling recently. Yeah. The Gift, The Debt, The Promise.
I reviewed a film last month called Worth. And I'm like, you just tell me what the title is. Oh, what are you going to see at the theaters? You want to see, like, Malignant or Worth? Just based on the title, I'm seeing a movie called Malignant because there's drama in that. Mm. Worth is a vague concept. That's not really going to get me.
That movie is about the worth of human life. Just call it The Value of Human Life.
Yeah.
Or that's what a is little
life,
bit more
what is life worth? That's actually, like, the actual quote from the movie. That's interesting.
Mm.
I feel like sometimes they're trying to make movies feel more generic, to be less threatening, but when actuality what they're doing is making them just less exciting, aren't they?
And when movies do get distributed internationally, I think the titles are then in the hands of the international distributor.
Usually, yes.
That's not the original maker's intent. It's not the screenwriter's intent. They don't translate their own film titles. Mm-hmm.
Often, the distributor allegedly has some kind of sense of what their market is interested in and what would work for that market. That's not necessarily the case, and we've all seen examples where, you know, the new title for something isn't as good as the old one.
And there are some amusing translations. I remember that the film Army of Darkness, which it's a film I love, but title's a little generic. The original intended title was going to be The Medieval Dead.
Great
little,
idea.
Little pun on Evil Dead.
Yeah. But they also wanted this one to kind of stand on its own and reach a bigger audience.
So they called it Army of Darkness, and when that was distributed in Japan, they translated it to Captain Supermarket. Because the idea was he works at, like, a Kmart at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
And then the climax of the movie is also in the Kmart.
Yeah.
An S-Mart in the world of the movie.
Yeah. Works.
But, yeah.
A lot of my favorite titles are really long.
I like the titles when... and there's a huge movement, especially when you look at anime or, like, Italian exploitation movies and spaghetti westerns. A lot of when they were released in the United States, they often just translated the titles quite literally.
Mm-hmm.
So what was Django Kill Shoot? What's the
Django Kill? If you live, shoot. That's one title.
Yeah.
that's a great title.
Clearly a literal translation of the Italian word.
Mm. I can't say that with any confidence, but it is a choice, and it is something that is very distinctive and... But yeah, I love it.
Would you rather see a film called The Promise? Do you remember what the movie I'm talking about when I say The Promise?
No.
Yeah. See,
Was Oscar Isaac in that?
Oscar Isaac was in
that. Okay, I'm not crazy. Okay, I vaguely remember The Promise.
No, it was about the Armenian Genocide.
That's it,
The Gift.
There's multiple films called The Gift.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sam Raimi did a film called The Gift. There was
Joel Edgerton did a film called The Gift.
Joel Edgerton, that thriller he did, yeah. Yeah.
Or the
movie. Very different films.
Yeah. And each of those films makes good use of that title.
Yeah, they're both accurately described, but they don't really stand out, do they? Mm. I remember I was listening to a commentary track for an early season, like the first season of The Family Guy.
Okay.
And if you look at it's actually weird. If you look at the first season or maybe two seasons of Family Guy, all the episode titles have nothing to do with the episode, and they sound like pulp detective stories. Like one of the first episodes is something like, I never knew the dead man. But it's an episode about how, like, Peter Griffin starts his own religion. Like, it has nothing to do with anything.
So and it's a little bit of... That was, like, one of the jokes of the show, I imagine.
It was an inside joke in the writer's room, and they just thought it'd be funny to name all the episodes, like, really cool-sounding, like, hard-boiled detective stories. And what they realized is that when they were trying to talk about the show and say, hey, remember in this one episode when we did this joke, we want to bring it back, or we set this thing up with Meg and now we want to, you know, use it again or ignore it.
They forgot the titles.
They can't remember what the hell they could. When no one remembered, like, what episode the title referred to, so it didn't really work. They were being too clever about it. Mm. Whereas I feel like if you make a movie with a title like The Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Stopped Living and Became Mixed Up Zombies, you're never going to confuse that with Night of the Living Dead. They're both zombie movies. You will never confuse those two films.
Yeah.
Or The Englishman Who Went Up a Hill But Came Down a Mountain. You know what movie that is. You'll never confuse that with Sense and Sensibility or Notting Hill. You know what Hugh Grant movie you got.
There aren't a lot of really unusual titles now. And I think it's important to grab the eye, and nobody seems to be interested in doing that. I do, to go back to the Avengers example, they were originally going to release Avengers Endgame, or Avengers Infinity War Part 1, and then Endgame was already called Avengers Infinity War Part 2. They're going to make it like into this big 5-hour thing.
That was probably the temp title when they were working on it, yeah. And then they used the word Endgame in the movie Avengers Infinity War, and they was like, okay, fuck it, let's call it that. And I'm like, there's so many cooler things. There's so much poetry in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, especially once you get into the weird space shit. You know? Like, I don't know. It could have been really good. Avengers, The Day the Universe Died. Like, that sounds cool. I want to see that. That sounds awesome. You know, those really cool titles is a filmmaking duo, Helene Catet and Bruno Forzani. They made three films so far.
The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears.
They made a film called The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears, which is an incredible title. It actually is relevant to the tone and the plot. And then they also made a really excellent grindhousey crime thriller film called Let the Corpses Tan, which is... Oh, that's a good title. It's a really underrated movie,
too. Don't prevent the corpses from tanning.
No. Leave them out. They'll tan. It'll be great. So I guess a lot of it comes down to preference. But I think that if you have a title that stands out, your title stands out. And I think that has value in and of itself. If when you're looking at a list of titles, the title that makes you go, wait, what's that? You know, there's a certain cachet that is sort of undeniable there. But there's also something to be said for simply, look, we got to call the movie something, and not every movie is trying to have a really good title. Personally, I think it's important. I think a title suggests something to the audience. It's the first start of a promise. And I think if you're not making the most of your title, you're not making the most of your movie. I think it's something that is one of the first things that a person in the audience knows about your movie. Even if they're just like flipping through channels and watching TV. Like, oh, what's on HBO right now? Oh, it's... Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key. Not generally on HBO, but whatever. It's a great Italian... Well, it's actually not that great an Italian movie, but it's a cool Italian movie.
Never Kill a Duckling.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's Never Torture a Duckling.
Never Torture a Duckling.
But yeah. Yeah, all of a sudden you're like, okay, I'll click on that. On the other hand, some people might get turned off by that, but at least they'll know the audience, you know?
Yeah.
But in any case, it's something that people deal with and wrestle with constantly. It's something that people get really tetchy about. I don't usually talk about a movie's title when I review a movie, but on the handful of occasions when I have, when I was like, this title doesn't really fit the film, and I think it sets you up for something bad, or the title suggests that the film is less interesting than it is, and the movie's actually really, really good. There's a movie I reviewed. It was a... indie comedy set in Austin called Love and Air Sex. And it is about a bunch of like 20 somethings dealing with life, love, and relationships. And the backdrop was there's a competition, I think, at the Alamo Draft House. And it was who can mime the most interesting sex scene.
Okay, like just themselves.
Yeah, just
okay.
miming. Nothing, no actual human contact. It's just miming. And it's actually not that important a part of the movie, but it's something that they could fit in there. And instead of just calling it, like, air sex, Love and Air Sex is a clunky title. Love and Air Sex doesn't really roll off the tongue. And I was like, you know, this movie's actually rather sweet and clever and has some good characters in it. Love and Air Sex, do not be put off by this kind of generic title. And it was just this general response, though, hey, whoa, they don't get to pick the title. And I'm like,
why not? Somebody gets to pick the title.
A, somebody gets to pick the title. And if they pick a bad title, we should be able to take them to task. And B, it's part of the film.
Mm.
It is. So, anyway. It's something that we deal with all the time, and some people care more than others, I guess.
Here are some titles of Harry Stephen Keeler novels. The Skull of the Waltzing Clown, When Thief Meets Thief.
Nice.
Finger! With exclamation points. The Man with the Magic Eardrums. The Case of the Lavender Gripsack. Cleopatra's Tears. That one's a little...
That's not bad. It's not bad. It's not as amazing as the others, but it's not bad.
The Case of the Crazy Corpse.
Mm.
This one's just called A Copy of Beowulf.
I like that.
The Case of the Two-Headed Idiot.
Nice.
Yeah, The Shark Skin Book. The Book with the Orange Leaves. The Case of the Two Strange Ladies.
Mm-hmm.
The Street of a Thousand Eyes. The Riddle of the Wooden Parakeet. These things are going to stand out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, The Case of the Transposed Legs.
Okay, that one's weird.
Yeah.
All right, anyway, we got to move on. But thank you for writing. Again, there's no real good answer to that one. It's something that there's a lot of factors that roll into. But hopefully you've got a sense of our take and maybe some of those factors and how they play into those decisions. What do we got next?
This one comes from Johannes. Hello, Johannes.
Hi.
Dear Bibbs and Meister of the Cool Rock.
Nice.
I had a great time listening to your Iron List episode on Alfred Hitchcock.
Ooh.
And I was very excited to hear some of the lesser-known Hitchcock movies get some attention. The classics are classics for a reason. Rear Window is just perfect, and Shadow of a Doubt is just so, so good. But Hitchcock made 53 movies, 54 if you count the lost The Mountain Eagle, and there are some real gems in there. For the past 2 years, I've been going through Hitchcock's entire filmography for my own podcast, Planet Film Geek, for anyone interesting.
Nice.
Interested and able to speak German. And I thought I'd share some of my favorite films of his that don't get enough attention.
Please do.
Number one, Lifeboat.
Yeah.
I was delighted to hear all the love for this movie in your episode, since I'd always heard of this one as more of a mediocre Hitchcock. And yes, it is just as exciting, suspenseful, and thought-provoking as you described. It is now a firm place in my top 10 Hitchcock movies. What a pleasant surprise. The same goes for number two, Foreign Correspondent.
Mm-hmm.
Also never discussed as one of Hitchcock's best, and also one of my absolute favorites, the way it captures the tensions in Europe pre-World War II, and the plea against American neutrality at the end is extremely powerful.
And it's one of the few Hitchcock films that was nominated for Best Picture. People forget that. It's like, yeah. You think that like North by Northwest would have been nominated, but no.
Foreign Correspondent was the one.
It's like four or five, I think, were nominated for Best Picture, and that's one of them.
Number three, Blackmail. I don't know Blackmail.
Oh, that was like the first sound film in England, if memory serves.
I might be alone with this one, but not only does Blackmail tell a thrilling and fast-paced crime story, it is also the first British film to incorporate sound.
I'm right.
There's a silent version and a silent/sound hybrid, which is just fascinating on a historical level.
Yeah, they did that a lot in the early, because not every movie theater was equipped for sound yet.
Yeah.
So they made two different versions of the film, so there's a lot of like, not all of them exist, but a lot of those early sound films have two different versions.
Yeah. Number four, The Wrong Man. This might be the most realistic portrayal of Hitchcock's fear of authority and being wrongfully incarcerated because it's based on a real case. Hmm. It's very different from a lot of Hitchcock's other movies because it tries to stick as closely as possible to real-life events. It's not as, quote, fun as a lot of his movies, but it is quite chilling and effective.
That's one of the few late-era Hitchcock films I actually haven't seen. I've been meaning to get around.
Was that, like, 70s Hitchcock?
It was 50s, but it was, like, late 50s, and I've seen, like, pretty much everything in that whole, like, from, like, the 50s to the 70s, I think, except for The Wrong Man. I think it's the only one I haven't gotten around to yet.
Yeah, he's been making movies since the
20s. Yeah, exactly.
And number five, Sabotage. This one's on the list for just how dark and twisted it is. Yeah. Hitchcock later described it as a mistake, but I really like the bleakness of this one. Those are some of my favorites I wanted to highlight. I had a lot of fun going through all of Hitchcock's movies and reading up on all the behind-the-scenes stuff, and I feel like I've taken a great class on film history. Also, Topaz is not Hitchcock's worst movie by far. Have you seen The Farmer's Wife?
No, I haven't seen The Farmer's Wife. I will make note of that.
Thanks for letting me nerd out about one of my favorite filmmakers, and thank you for all the great work you do. Greetings from Germany, Johannes.
Thank you, Johannes. It sounds like a great podcast you're doing. Yeah, Sabotage, I didn't mention. Sabotage is a really bleak film, and it's about a saboteur in England who runs a movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
And while the movies are running, he like in the projection booth, he like runs out, commits sabotage, and runs back.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a scene in that movie where it's like a ticking clock, and it's like, when will the bomb go off? And like, oh no, how will this kid get out of this? And yeah, it's not that kind of movie. Just horrible shit happens to people in that movie. And I think that's, and Hitchcock talks about learning a lesson how, like, people don't want, people want the threat of innocent people dying. They don't actually want it to happen. You know? Like, they don't actually, like, you wouldn't do a scene where it's just like, oh yeah, Ethan Hunt's, like, you don't generally have a scene where, like, Ethan Hunt's wife is, like, trapped in a room with the bomb, and he's trying to save her, and then he doesn't in the middle of the movie.
Yeah.
And then she just dies horribly, and it's a real bummer. Like, you can't, the movie can't quite recover from that. Mm. You can't have it be, like, a satisfying heroic conclusion, because it's just a real fucking drag.
Yeah. There's... although I do appreciate when a film does get that daring.
Sure, some, it can't
sometimes
work,
yeah. It will, like, you know, Psycho is a good example of that. Yeah. You know, let's change protagonists partway through the movie. That's not a spoiler anymore. People know that.
Yeah.
There was a not at all very good movie from, I think, the early 2000s called 15 Minutes.
It had with Ed Burns,
Ed
right?
Ed Burns and Robert De Niro were in that.
It was
about
that.
A group of criminals who were trying to become famous by committing crimes.
Yeah.
Like, that, their goal was the infamy they would gain.
I remember, like, that came out around the same time, like, within a year or two of the movie Showtime, which also had...
Robert De Niro, but it was, like, Eddie Murphy in that one.
Yeah, and I, for some reason, I thought they were kind of the same film, and I never watched either of them.
Well, Showtime is about cops who are being filmed, and...
Yeah, 15 minutes is about criminals who are filming themselves.
Yeah, and
you can see how, like, how they feel like of a piece. I wonder if that'd be a good double feature.
Robert De Niro and Ed Burns play the cops or the feds. I don't remember the finer details. I rarely do, but I do remember in that movie that in order to become famous, they've got the drop on Robert De Niro. It's like, oh well, if they kill him, they'll be really famous. Oh, but he's Robert De Niro. You can't get. Oh shit, Robert De Niro's dead.
Oh shit!
Halfway through the movie, Robert De Niro's just out.
I mean,
it's like the biggest
alert
star.
For a 20-year-old movie you weren't going
to see. You weren't
going
to watch 15 Minutes.
No one. If anyone
if,
in
if
our
anything,
audience,
if anything, that twist is the selling point on 15 Minutes.
Yeah,
so I'm
like, seriously, but they seem more interested in seeing it.
Yeah.
Because you know, we all know, like, the twist and, like, executive decision is that Steven Seagal is not in that movie as much as you'd think.
Yeah.
But somehow that one had not gotten out. Some people do not talk about that. So yeah, 15 minutes.
Because nobody cared about 15 minutes.
A movie you were not going. That was not on your list. Or it was not in, like, the top 20 movies you were going to see next. If it was, we apologize. Please let us know.
It's a candidate for Average Fest.
Yeah,
like 15 minutes.
I'm more curious to see it. You know, this is a digression. I'll make it quick. Remember, it was such a big deal when Pacino and De Niro were not only going to be in the same film but in the same scene in the movie Heat.
Uh-huh.
And it was great, and it's a great movie. It's one of the best movies of the 90s. And then they did a movie where they spent pretty much the whole movie together called Righteous Kill, and it sucks.
Nobody cares because
it's
bad.
A bad movie. It's a really bad... It is such a bummer that we finally get a movie where they get to spend the entire film interacting, and it stinks. And then we got The Irishman, and that ended up being really, really great. But, like, yeah, if Righteous Kill was the only time they spent the whole movie together... Ooh, that would have been rough.
If there's anything we've learned from those terrible Expendables movies,
yeah,
it's that stunt casting doesn't really extend all that far.
Funnily enough, I remember watching Righteous Kill, and we'll get back to letters in a second, I apologize. But I remember watching Righteous Kill, and Curtis 50 Cent Jackson is in that movie.
Uh-huh.
And I remember thinking to myself, is Curtis Jackson a better actor than Robert De Niro and Al Pacino right now? Because I think he might be. Which is no slight against Curtis 50 Cent Jackson, but it's not what you'd expect. You've got Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, arguably the two greatest actors of their generation. And they're getting out-acted by Curtis
by 50
Jackson.
Cent, yeah.
Yeah, did not see that one coming. Good for you, 50 Cent. Bad for you, Pacino and De Niro. Let's move on.
Here's a letter from Todd.
Hello, Hi, Todd.
Good morning, noon, and night. What was the first show... That you binged through.
Oh, that's interesting.
In my day, we called it a marathon. When I initially came up with this question a few minutes ago, I thought my answer was Farscape, back when I originally brought the series DVDs and fourth season when the fourth season was released in full. Now, as I write this, I realize it might have easily have been Cowboy Bebop, Trigun, or maybe even Robotech. Anyway, I was just curious to hear your answers. Thank you, Todd.
That's interesting. I definitely...
We're old... And we're old enough to remember before
binging was
an entire season of television was available in one place.
Yeah, it used to be even if there were very infrequent home video releases of whole TV shows on VHS. And it was often a practicality thing. You could only fit two or three episodes of most shows
on a tape.
And so to have a complete set, it would take up like a whole shelf on a bookshelf.
Yeah.
And I've seen a few sets like that. They had like a Highlander, the TV series set like that, which is
Columbia
huge.
House. Columbia House did that.
Yeah, it was gigantic.
Columbia House did that with Star Trek and Star Trek The Next Generation. Yeah. You could get two episodes per tape.
Mm-hmm.
And they would send you, like, one a month. Yeah. You get two episodes a month.
Twin Peaks had a big-ass set like that, but again, really uncommon. So,
and they were really expensive, too, if you wanted to buy an entire series on VHS.
I remember you used to see that they had a big like, special place for them at Suncoast Video that was, like, only for really rich people to get as Christmas presents.
Yeah, these gigantic box sets.
Yeah, I was really jealous of them. I didn't even want them, but I was like, I don't want to watch every single episode of Highlander because I never got into that show. But I also want that VHS set.
Just because it's so nice.
If I ever find that at like a Goodwill or something, I'm totally buying it. Because there's no way that even at Goodwill today, if they had the whole set, there's no way they'd sell it for like more than $50. Yeah, and even that's probably
like $20.
I would totally buy that right now.
Just so it looked good.
Yeah, it'd be awesome. What a great conversation piece, you know?
I know in the early 2000s when DVDs really started taking off, and DVDs were more successful than anybody ever thought they were going to be. And
they were compact. They had better video and audio quality.
Yeah, they got scooped up.
Laserdisc had already been around for a long time, but it was just impractical, and the technology never really caught on in America, and DVD was more convenient.
Yeah, and it was the first time where an entire season of television, A, could fit in a much smaller package, and B, flirted with affordable. It's like, okay, I can spend $60 for a season of television, and that's not so bad. And these days, you can get a whole season of television for almost nothing.
Yeah, that's true.
But the two I remember really causing a splash were Firefly and 24.
Yeah, Firefly was saved by DVD. The DVDs sold so well of Firefly, which lasted only about 13 episodes, but only like 10 of them aired. And we did a whole Patreon exclusive series.
Where
we did
one episode podcast devoted to Firefly.
Yeah, one podcast per episode / movie. That show was not a hit on TV, largely because people wanted to like it, but the network kept like airing the episodes out of order, and it got really confusing. But when they put it on DVD in order, all of a sudden people were like, "Hey, we like this show. We would have watched this." And Fox is like, "Shit.
Well, fine, buy the DVDs and just keep buying those so we don't have to spend any more money."
And they did, and then the DVDs sold so well they made a movie, and then the movie wasn't a big hit. Because as many people bought the DVDs, that's still a lot fewer people than go see movies on a mainstream basis, it was still pretty niche. But I think the first season... Shit. You know what I used to be able to get was a whole bunch of VHSs of anime. Anime was often quite available. So I think the first one I binged, I don't think I got through the whole season because the series was really long, but I think the first one I ever binged was Ranma One Half.
Okay.
Which is a very weird series about a martial arts master who, when you splash, I think,
when
cold
you get them,
water on him, it's like...
When you get them wet, their bodies shapeshift.
Yeah, and like his dad changes into a giant panda, but when Ranma changes, he changes into a girl.
Yeah, female version of himself.
And everyone in the show, except for, like, his close relatives, are, like, romantically attracted either to Ranma or the female version of Ranma. Mm. And I remember thinking to myself, this is, like, kind of interestingly progressive at the time. It is probably aged very poorly.
It's all gay panic jokes.
It's not great. But, like, I remember at the time thinking to myself, well, this is neat. No one else is really engaging with this. Mm. So I think I binged that. I also binged... all of Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Mm-hmm.
I binged... The series wasn't done yet, but I binged every like season of 24 because I got started on that late.
Yeah. 24 was a big hit on DVD because of the construct of the show.
Yeah.
It takes place in real time. Each hour of show is 1 hour of actual time. And
24 was one of the first shows to release the entire first season before the second season aired.
Yeah.
And that was a huge help because people bought it, they binged it, and then season two was a bigger hit than season one because more people had caught up.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. We didn't mention this, but anime was another big market for like gigantic season long box sets. Mm-hmm. Those were, you know, prime collector's items for people who are interested in the format. But
another thing we haven't talked about is that before we had binging and before we had TV that was regularly available on streaming and home video to be all absorbed at once, the other version we had of that was TV marathons.
Yeah, on Thanksgiving, you could watch many, many episodes of the Twilight Zone.
Typically, like the Twilight Zone was a very popular one, but they've also done others as well. There used to be X-Files marathons, Buffy marathons, other marathons as well. Farscape used to have marathons. So that was definitely, I probably the first thing I technically binged was Twilight Zone on those marathons. I would literally spend all day on Thanksgiving binging the Twilight Zone. I remember thinking to myself, when dinner was ready, I'm like, shit, I'm going to miss this episode of Twilight Zone because I had to spend time with my damn family eating good food. Which tells you a lot about me, I guess.
I did the same with Mystery Science Theater. They did the Turkey Day marathons.
Yeah, they did that too, yeah.
And I didn't have cable TV, so I didn't have like ready access to it. But my dad took me on vacation to a motel, and there was cable TV in the motel. And it was difficult to split the time with, you know, wanting to spend time with my dad.
And wanting to watch Mystery Science Theater
back in the hotel
room. If you had known eventually it would all be on streaming, would you have been, like, spending more time with your dad, or would you still not want to
miss it? I regret every second I've spent in front of the television. I spent my youth playing video games, and I wish I hadn't.
Yeah, I hear you.
But, yeah, I think Tenchi in Tokyo was one of the first like anime series. A friend of mine like lent me this big pile of cassettes, and I watched all of those.
Oh, Spaced was like only available in bootlegs in America. Oh, I binged that in, like, one day. Yeah.
I'm trying to think, because that wasn't really the way I consumed television. Yeah. I didn't start doing that until I was a little older, so I can't remember.
Yeah, it wasn't until like marathons, maybe, I think maybe Ranma, but other than that, I think it wasn't until like the early 2000s that
I watched Star Trek marathons and Twilight Zone marathons on TV, but that's kind of it.
All right, let's move on.
All right. This is a letter from Nikolai.
Hello, hi, Nikolai.
Hello again, fine gents. I hope the fall of 2021 has made the pandemic closer to a sad memory than a present reality for you. Things have eased up so much here in Scandinavia to a point where... Oh, Scandinavia, you're just so great, aren't you? Things are great. Scandinavia is... I've been, and it's nice.
Nice.
To a point where most over the age of 15 have been fully vaccinated. We're only waiting for those who refuse to receive the vaccinations, which means our daily lives are pretty much close to back to normal. Bars, restaurants, theaters, and cinemas are up and running.
Congratulations.
And I've enjoyed the comfort of the pitch-black cinema halls with a massive bowl of popcorn several times since. I went to see Dune the other night, and I cannot wait to hear your review of it.
That's right. That's out already over there.
Yeah, we haven't seen the new Dune film yet.
Weird release schedule on that one. Yeah.
Without giving anything away, I've seen it twice already, and I absolutely loved it. And for the love of God, don't see it on HBO Max. It deserves the biggest screen you can get.
Oh, well, I'll see it however I can.
I'll see. Yeah, well, we might have to see it on a laptop. Yeah, that's just the way it shakes out for us.
That's
sometimes.
Life. We HBO Max is also available on our TVs. We have nice TVs. You know,
just when and where Catch as Catch Can. I understand that's not ideal, but it is how we can
get it.
See
every
the
movie,
films.
It would be nice to see every movie on the big screen, but it's not practical, and it's not something we're always going to be able to do. And if they don't work at home, they don't work.
Yeah. I have a question regarding a very important topic in the film industry, and that is female directors. While I'm more than delighted to see an increasing amount of women getting work and putting out fantastic movies in recent years, Greta Gerwig, Olivia Wilde, Catherine Bigelow, Patty Jenkins, Julia Ducournau, and many others, including Lynn Ramsey, one of my favorite directors, have put out films. I do find it fascinating to look back at film history and see where some of these brilliant women are to be found. Yeah, it's a sexist industry. Men directed the bulk of films for many decades. And while, or at least they were credited.
That's true,
While they were definitely not easy to find, I did come across two women directors, and I was hoping the two of you could shine some light on why they seem to have been completely forgotten in time. Number one, Ida Lupino.
Yeah, I was about this. Yeah. I assumed this was coming up,
I didn't know about her until a couple of years ago when Martin Scorsese mentioned her in an interview that many of his visual expressions in his movies were influenced by Lupino. I recently watched her directorial work, The Hitchhiker, and oh my god, it's great! I'm planning to watch The Bigamist next, and I cannot wait. I also know that her one Twilight Zone episode, nicknamed The Masks, that she directed, should be on my to-watch list, and I will get to it eventually.
Cool. I've seen the Twilight Zone episode. That's a great episode, I've seen fewer films than I'd like, but let's finish reading.
And number two, this one is controversial, but hear me out, Leni Riefenstahl.
Oh, interesting.
Don't get me wrong, I in no way, shape, or form support the Nazi regime, which she became known for in terms of her film productions. But I can't deny that she, as a craftsperson, both The Triumph of the Will and Olympia are spectacular pieces of film art, and that Riefenstahl was a master of her work. There are definitely directors in recent years, such as certain X-Men and Valerian directors, of which I do not wish to name names, that that deserve to be forgotten. But with Riefenstahl, I think we should at least admire her skills. Maybe not her results or mindset, but at least her abilities. So my question is simply, why do you think some of these women have been forgotten, especially now that more women than ever are stepping behind the camera? Mm-hmm. I'm aware that there are other women in old Hollywood, but I'm simply not aware of them, which right. is why my friend recently suggested I should buy Alicia Malone's book, Backwards in Heels.
Great book.
Yes, you should.
Great book.
Which I'm looking forward to digging into. Also, if you can recommend other old Hollywood female directors, that would be very much appreciated.
Ah.
Wish you the best and hope we had an awesome summer. Lots of love from the colder north than Canada.
Well, thank you so much for writing in. And yeah, it's unfortunate that... Well, there's a lot of unfortunate things here. First off, I do want to clarify that this is a bit of a misconception. When filmmaking was just getting started in the silent era, there were actually quite a few female filmmakers who were very prolific.
Oh, indeed.
And very successful. But because the silent era has largely been lost. I mean, literally lost. Like, a significant number of the films from the silent era are probably vanished from the face of the earth and will never be seen again because they weren't cared for, they were forgotten, they were destroyed, they weren't properly stored. Mm. A lot of people's work is, if it's available, it's not readily available, it's not easy to track down. Please, 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 if you care at all about this stuff, or even if you think you might, follow Movies Silently on Twitter. They are constantly writing about and exploring and discovering new and interesting things about the silent era, and they're debunking a lot of the myths about it as well, because there's a lot of things people sort of assume about the silent era which aren't factually accurate or are based on hearsay, propaganda, or lies. So that's someone to definitely look into, and they talk a lot about the early female filmmakers from the silent era and beyond, and I am not as equipped as them to talk about that. Regarding Ida Lupino, definitely one of the great female filmmakers of the mid-20th century. There, around the time sound came along, and they were starting to see fewer and fewer women directing films within the Hollywood studio system, which is fucking bullshit, and there's no excuse for it. And so, like, a huge chunk of the golden age of Hollywood, as we tend to focus on it, doesn't have as many women in it. One huge exception to that, and I want to recommend a podcast to talk about it, is Dorothy Arzner.
Yeah.
The great B. Peterson, who was just on an episode of Critically Reclaimed, where we talked about silent Shakespeare, speaking of silent movies, and Mark Edward Hoik did a wonderful retrospective podcast called Friends of Dorothy, where they talked about every single movie Dorothy Arzner directed.
They did two.
Apologies.
There was B and Mark did Dance Dorothy Dance.
Yes,
which, that was it. Because she did a film called Dance Girl Dance.
I apologize.
Dance Dorothy Dance was the retrospective on Dorothy Arzner's films,
yes.
And Friends of Dorothy was, isn't that cute?
Yeah.
Were about, like, people who worked with Dorothy Arzner or were known to be associated with Dorothy Arzner.
Yeah, a great, great series. You'll learn a lot, and you'll find out about a lot of movies that I haven't seen yet even, and so I do want to guide you to the people who know even more than we do. So that's a great example right there. In particular, Leni Riefenstahl, I think I'm pronouncing that right, I could be wrong.
Riefenstahl.
Is it Riefenstahl?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Leni Riefenstahl, if you don't know the name... Leni Riefenstahl was an actor and then a filmmaker who is considered one of the more influential documentary filmmakers in terms of their presentation. But also, they directed Nazi propaganda and New Hitler, and their film Triumph of the Will is considered one of the most important pieces of Nazi propaganda in World War II that really desperately tried to... sell the audience on the greatness, or the so-called greatness, rather, of the Third Reich. The imagery that Riefenstahl captured in Triumph of the Will is so just, it's incredibly framed, we can agree on that much, I suppose, that a lot of filmmakers have used it as inspiration for whenever they make a movie about fascism, or even that's evoking fascism, everything from Star Wars...
To the latest My Little Pony movie.
To the Lord of the Rings. Like, this is the cinematic language of fascistic evil, even though the movie was convinced otherwise.
So we
don't really talk about Leni Riefenstahl very often, even though they made a lot of acclaimed documentaries, look what they did.
Here's also a way to look at the Triumph of the Will. A lot of people say just sort of how exhilarating it is, a work of propaganda. And if you were a member of the Nazi Party, it would be great for you, right? Maybe not. I remember Roger Ebert had a series of essays he was doing called Great Films. It was just every other week he'd write a new essay about a film that he considered to be great.
Yeah.
And eventually he came to The Triumph of the Will. He wanted to address it because he said Roger Ebert kept on hearing about how what an exhilarating piece of work it was. And he compared it to the movie Woodstock.
Okay.
These are both movies about gigantic events.
Mm-hmm.
One is the 1934 Nuremberg Rally. One is Summer of Love Woodstock, the concert film. And Woodstock isn't just the performances.
Mm-hmm.
We get to go down into the audience. We get to see how they organize things. There's a lot of dirt and talk about what a massive undertaking all of this was to construct something like Woodstock.
Yeah, it's an image of the
logistics of actually making a concert of this size.
It's a historical document.
Yeah, so they're covering a lot of bases. The Triumph of the Will has none of that. What went into making a rally like this? How do you get people there? Where do they stay?
Mm-hmm.
Are they staying in local motels?
It's not trying to be informative about the event.
Exactly. It's just the event itself, and that's actually an incredibly boring way to look at an event like this. Just seeing the event and it almost feels like a highlight reel. So ever since I read that, I thought of The Triumph of the Will as maybe not as dynamic as I thought it was.
Yeah.
All it did is give us the language of fascism that we've been borrowing from to express fascism in future films.
Yeah.
Lenny Riefenstahl, interesting person.
Lived a very long life. Kept working afterwards, somehow.
There's a biopic of Jesse Owens called, cleverly, Race.
Oh, yeah.
And Lenny Riefenstahl is in that. She's played by Carice Van Houten from Black Books.
Oh, well,
she just has a small bit, but in that film, she's depicted as somebody who's making these films as a survival technique under fascism, but really she wasn't a fascist herself.
Uh-huh.
That's sort of the implication in that movie.
Yeah, I've heard that touted. I've also heard it said that the exact opposite is true, and it's hard to say.
And there's documentary films about personal, her and her life. But
without personal research and going through all the biographies, I don't know if I could say that for myself.
There are many other names you can celebrate other than Leni Riefenstahl, whose works are historically significant, but not grand filmmaking the way some of your film schools might have said.
Yeah. Who are some other female filmmakers, maybe, that we can recommend here? This is a little later. I'm a big fan of Claire Denis. Agnes Varda.
Yeah, I was about to say Varda is incredibly significant.
One of my favorite auteurs of the 80s who doesn't get talked about enough, and I think I just talked about them on... what was it? What were we talking about? We were talking about them, I think, on Star Trek or something like that. Or maybe it was critically acclaimed. But anyway, Susan Seidelman is a really, really underappreciated filmmaker, I think, from the 80s. She made a lot of really amazing, thoughtful films, but there were also many of them quite big hits. Films like Desperately Seeking Susan. Yeah,
if you like experimental filmmaking, go with Maya Deren. She made some pretty out there experimental shorts.
Yeah. A filmmaker who actually made a movie about kind of what we're talking about. We have to recommend Watermelon Woman.
Oh yeah.
Watermelon Woman is actually a film about a documentarian who is trying to research female performers, particularly of color, and directors from the silent era, and trying to uncover their stories because those stories are long since lost. Mm. And because they couldn't really tell a story about the subject they wanted to, they had to invent the history.
Yeah.
Because vanished.
We're the queer women of color in classic Hollywood.
Good luck finding a lot of material on that. There's not a lot.
You didn't say her name, but it's made by Cheryl Dunier.
Cheryl
Dunier made a film called The Watermelon Woman in the mid-90s, and it's like super 90s, but it's also really exhilarating filmmaking.
Yeah.
There's a lot of women working right now. I was really excited to... I'm reviewing a lot more films by women. Mm-hmm. They're making them to me more than they did in the past. I don't want to say more women are making films. Women have always been making films, but they've been making their way into sort of mainstream attention more and more.
Mm-hmm.
Watch Penelope Spheeris films. Penelope Spheeris did a few sort of well-regarded mainstream Hollywood comedies in the 90s, but she also did a really excellent series of documentaries called The Decline of Western Civilization back in the 80s. Those are great.
Chantal Ackerman
is a really important filmmaker. If you I'm not super familiar with the lyrics of Lena Wertmüller.
Same.
But I know Lena Wertmüller has a lot of really sort of important, notable works.
One of the bigger, you probably know because you were talking about the more recent ones, but Catherine Bigelow as well was a prominent work. Who did that amazing, was it Born to Kill? No, it wasn't Born to Kill. That was Seiji Suzuki. Who was the one who did the documentary-styled sci-fi film from the early 80s, Born in Flames?
Oh, that was, you put me on the spot. Lizzie Borden.
Lizzie Borden. Yeah. Look up Lizzie Borden. Please look up Lizzie Borden.
Born in Flames is excellent. I love Born in Flames.
And really prescient, holy shit. So anyway, hopefully this is a start. We are not the world's greatest expert in every single aspect of cinema, and there are other people who are even better to follow here. Hopefully we've recommended a few of them. Please, 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 everybody, whether we're talking to you specifically because you wrote this email or just in general, please seek out more films directed by women.
Yeah.
Please pick up more films directed by queer people. People who are maybe trans or non-binary. Please seek out films directed by people of color, people from different cultures. It's so easy to just look at what's easily available, and what's easily available is often whatever is closest to us, because it's the most marketed. It's whatever is biggest in our neighborhood or in our country. And or whatever has the most money thrown at it, which oftentimes is very exclusionary.
If
you put the effort in, you're going to really discover the world of cinema is a lot more interesting than you already thought it was.
I think this is why there's been such a push to hire women to direct, like, the giantest of blockbusters.
Yeah.
It's like Patty Jenkins directed two Wonder Woman films. One of them is pretty good. And
And she's going to do a Star Wars film now. Good for her.
Oh, is she really?
Yeah, I think it's a Rogue Squadron. It's about, like, it's like Top Gun. Okay, kind of vibe,
I've so lost the thread on Star Wars. It's like Star Wars seems like a bunch of clutter now. It's like there's eight of these shows.
It used
now.
To be there were the movies, and if you were interested in the side stuff, that was the side stuff. And now it's all like you have to follow all of it, and it's getting a little more difficult,
really
isn't
complicated.
That,
you know? While I think it's great that a director like Chloe Zhao is doing a Marvel superhero film, how's that gonna work? I'm really fascinated.
It should be interesting, right?
At least it's going to be interesting, failure or success. But women are making movies all the time, and there are a lot of really wonderful movies out there, but because a lot of people only see, like, the biggest of the big, or the most advertised, or the highest moneyed, that seems like one of the only, like, the last place where women can break through so they actually get attention as artists.
If artists are kept out of the most mainstream of spaces, whether that's because they are queer or people of color or women or anything else, really, that I haven't even... people with disabilities, for example, then those stories aren't reaching as many people. And those people and a lot of people who consume media very casually... and aren't really thinking about what they consume, which is a lot of people. It's how I consume music most of the time. I'm a very casual music fan. I don't know a lot about music. Or at least I don't follow it as closely as I do film. What you happen to be incidentally exposed to can become your whole world.
Yeah.
And as a result, we have to be very careful about making sure that these places and these art forms and these studio projects, as big as they are... actually taking into consideration the fact that there's a lot of different people in the world and they all have stories to tell on their own perspectives, and it's important that we give space for that. We're in the weeds here. We have time for a couple more emails, maybe two more. So what do we got?
Sure. Here's an email from Tim. Tim says, "Hey Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool, what do you think of the way people with disabilities are portrayed in mainstream movies?"
Okay.
As a disabled man, I'm quite annoyed with the way Hollywood constantly casts non-disabled actors to play disabled characters. Bryan Cranston in The Upside, Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot, or people with disabilities are treated as a burden, as in Me Before You. Tell me what you think. Thanks for everything you do, Tim.
This is
a big topic.
This is a huge topic. It's a little. We were kind of actually accidentally segued into it a little bit, but people with disabilities are not treated very well in society at large. And I think that's nothing controversial to say. What was that documentary? It was a Crypt Camp. There was a documentary that came out last year on Netflix called Crypt Camp.
Yeah.
And it's a really, really good documentary. I highly recommend it.
It's produced by Obama's production
company. Yeah. And it was about the first summer camp in America for people with disabilities. And for a lot of people with disabilities, this was like their only opportunity, or their first opportunity at least, to be in an environment where they were surrounded by people who, maybe their disabilities were different, but were going through similar experiences, and they were able to, instead of feeling like they were other, they felt like a part of a group. And a lot of them talk about how incredibly empowering that was, and how that gave them something to shoot for, something they didn't know was possible. Because too much of the world that they lived in, especially in the mid-20th century, but still now, isn't really geared for them. There weren't enough ramps on streets, for example, or going into buildings. Then that's just one of many, many, many examples. And then a lot of those people ended up becoming activists who pushed for many decades to improve the world for people with disabilities, and it's something that we're still struggling with today. Please do your research into this. I'm not the world's greatest expert at this. But there's a lot to learn here. And unfortunately, a lot of the entertainment industry is still very exclusionary. There's still a lot of... Here's a good example. There's a lot of the move to streaming has allowed people who otherwise maybe have mobility issues, or in the case of a pandemic, people with compromised immune systems, they can't really go to the theater. And so seeing more movies at home increases the accessibility of films. There is a new Apichatpong Wirasithikul. I came so close. There's a new movie that
directed from
the director of Uncle Boonmi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives and Cemetery Splendor. He's got a new movie starring Tilda Swinton. Is it called, was it Memoria?
Memoria. The title.
And the idea
just today announced the release pattern for Memoria.
It will never be on streaming. It will never be on home video. It will only be in theaters, and it will like have like a roadshow thing and constantly move around.
It'll play in every theater in this country for 1 week a piece, and it'll just like stay playing forever.
And that's, on the surface, that might briefly sound like a neat idea, but when you think about it for any meaning, you think about who is being permanently excluded from seeing this film. That sucks. And it shows just how little people are thinking about this.
Alonso Duralde's Twitter joke was, Uncle Boonmi, who can't make it that week. If you can't make it that week, you just don't get to see this new film.
Or if you can't make it to a theater because it's impractical, or the theaters aren't designed for you where you live. That sucks. That is the sort of the super narrative here. That's what's going on in reality.
Well, that's accessibility.
But it shows just how little the studios are really thinking about this.
And Tim was also talking about representation in film.
I was leading into that. I think that shows why representation in film is just part of a big tapestry of how they're not really thinking about this well enough.
Disabled narratives in films are, they're typically treated as, they're clearly written by able-bodied people.
Frequently.
They're not...
Yeah.
Or, if...
I can't say that's a universally true thing, but often that's the case. Yeah.
It's really rare that a character is incidentally disabled in a film.
That's the thing that really infuriates me. We don't see people who just incidentally... For example, Venom, for example. The new Venom, a movie I liked, there's a character with a hearing aid. That's a plot point.
Yeah.
Like, it can't just be a person with a hearing aid. You can't just be a person who happens to be in a wheelchair, a person who has any number of many disabilities people live with every day. It's always related to the plot in some way, in almost any mainstream studio
film. The disability, is part of the story in a lot of these movies. They cast able-bodied actors to play disabled people. Not knowing that, or not recognizing, or not even thinking that there might be some disabled actors out there.
Oftentimes their excuse is, we want to make sure we can tell a story from before they became disabled. And so we need to show them walking around.
Have them be able-bodied for a part of the movie.
But that's not always the case, and they still do it anyway. Mm. And also that the absolute emphasis on people who didn't have a disability, something happened, and now they do, is sort of erasing from a lot of these narratives the fact that a lot of people are born with disabilities and they're living their lives through that, and that sucks.
There are a few good examples. There's a mumblecore film called Beeswax from the mid-2000s that was really good about a disabled photographer, and her disability is just an incidental part of her life.
I would say
there was a movie earlier this year called Coda, which stands for Children of Deaf Adults, and that had Marley Matlin, let me look at the actors, Troy Kotsur and Daniel Durant, three actual deaf actors who are playing deaf characters. And while their deafness is a big part of the main character's narrative, they're depicted as well-rounded, interesting human beings.
Yeah.
They're not sort of defined by their inability to hear.
I'll give an example that is... people in the horror community point out this a lot, but a lot of people outside of the horror community aren't aware of at least the attempts that were made by these movies to be progressive in this regard. Curse of Chucky and Cult of Chucky. Mm-hmm. Starring Fiona Dorff. She's the protagonist of those two films, and she's in a wheelchair.
Oh, that's right.
For those two films. And her portrayal as someone who is living with a disability, making the most of it. She's actually, here's something you almost never see in a movie with someone with a disability. There's a sex scene. She gets to have an actual, like, positive at the time. It's a horror movie. It doesn't all go well, but like an actual she has the strength to control the situation.
She has sex and it's fun,
and it's on her own terms. That's it, you know, and like, so that's something that it doesn't get depicted enough. So although Fiona Dorff is not disabled, the actual depiction of the movies, and kudos to Don Mancini for making the effort, is often heralded as one of the better recent examples of someone who is incidentally disabled, and the narrative works around them, and they're good movies. I like those movies.
And another one that people don't think about a lot, and again, Jay Baruchel, who plays the part, isn't disabled, but Hiccup from How to Train Your Dragon 2.
That's a great example.
He loses a foot in the first movie, and
half leg.
And he has a prosthetic through the other two movies, and that's that.
Yeah, and it's rarely an issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's very heroic, and I know I've heard it from a lot of young people saying that that's a very heroic character because look what they're going through, and look, they're still the protagonist of this major. Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, it's something that is in other movies, but it's not really addressed very often. Anakin Skywalker and Luke Skywalker both lose hands.
Yeah,
they have prosthetics, and they're like so good that they don't really think about it very much, but they are.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that doesn't get discussed very often. But then you also have the issue of what is Darth Vader? He's someone who's basically in a walking iron lung. Mm. He's demonized. His breathing is symbolic of evil.
Yeah.
That's something we don't really talk about a lot.
I wouldn't call Darth Vader the most positive example.
No, but that's a negative example. Sometimes Hollywood fucks it up, is my point.
William and I are not disabled.
I have a bad knee. There's some, to a degree, I am, but I'm certainly not like, I'll never run again.
So
like,
I'm going,
that's something that sucks. Like, I'll never sprint down the street ever again. That sucks. So to a degree,
My point being, rather than listen to us, I'm going to, as the final word on this matter, I'm going to point you toward Kristen Lopez.
Yes.
A disabled film critic.
Writes very eloquently about
one of the better
constantly.
Film critics working, and also writes very eloquently about disabled representation, accessibility, et cetera, et cetera. All of the issues that disabled film critics must deal with. And she's very candid and eloquent about such issues.
Please follow them. Their Twitter account is journeys_film. They also write for IndieWire. They're the TV editor for IndieWire, and they host a lot of podcasts as well. She's great.
She's wonderful. Yeah. Kristen's really great.
Huge fan.
Listen to Kristen Lopez.
Okay. And I think we have time for one more.
One last
We'll do the best we can on these topics, but, you know, we're not only so well-equipped.
Here's something that's a little fun. This one comes from Dr. Nova. Hello, Dr. Nova. Hi, Biz and Rockmeister McCool. I thought it would be really fun to put together my version of the Avengers. So I've done that. Here are 5-ish characters that I think would work well together as a superhero team.
Okay.
Captain Amelia and Mr. Arrow from Treasure Planet.
Nice!
We have the perfect pairing and they have a spaceship. Captain Amelia can also be the leader and Mr. Arrow is the muscle. Mr. Arrow in that one, it's like the thing. It's like a big rock guy.
Yeah.
Rita from Edge of Tomorrow. That's the Emily Blunt character.
Yeah,
she has 100 years of combat experience and a power suit for Iron Man like tinkering. The bankroller, Gomez Adams. Not only is he spectacularly rich, but he has the power of luck and invulnerability, possibly due to luck.
Nice.
Gloria from the movie Colossal. Anne Hathaway's character.
That's a choice. That could be interesting. Yeah.
She can be the Hulk character, and her origin movie can help recognize abuse. And Stitch from Lilo and Stitch. He's a smart, strong alien that can throw buildings at people and do science. Signed, Dr. Nova.
Love it. Love it. That's fun.
I was first getting into Marvel Comics, I wasn't getting into the comics. A friend of mine collected the Marvel superhero trading cards and brought them to, Boy Scout meetings, and we'd pore over these characters, and we'd memorize stats, and they'd have, a little brief origin story on the back of the card. And we would assemble teams, just for fun. This was before I even touched a Marvel comic book.
Right.
So I was really familiar with the entire canon of characters before I even started to pick up a book. And when I finally bought my first Marvel comic, it was the Infinity Gauntlet, number one. I already kind of knew who all of those characters were and kind of what their relationships were. I had already been given this primer. Making fake superhero teams was such a fun thing to do when you're 12 years old.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to have Darkhawk and Daredevil and Rogue and Iceman. And they're all on a team together. And,
wait a minute. You don't have a strong guy. You got to have a strong guy. Oh, okay, what about strong guy?
Strong guy from X-Factor. Strong guy. Yeah.
Actual guy, because his name is Strong Guy. I've often thought about that. I remember when The Expendables came out, I remember thinking to myself, you know what they should do? And it's something that I'm surprised they haven't. Do that with horror. There's so many horror icons.
Well, they tried to do that with the Dark Universe thing.
No. I'm not talking about, like, the Wolfman and shit. I'm talking about actors.
Okay.
Like, think about, like, because if you think about it, here are a bunch of actors who, they're getting older, they've only got, like, so much more time with them where they can really do something really active. And a lot of them will do, like, cameos and little things in movies. But what if we had a horror movie that wasn't just, that didn't just feature cameos from, but actually had them as a cool ensemble cast, either playing familiar characters or versions of them, with people like Robert Englund, Bruce Campbell,
Kane Hodder, Tony Todd.
Tony Todd, exactly.
Keith David, Ken Foree, all those, like...
That's a really cool idea.
Linnea Quigley.
Yeah. Do it. Like, that's a cool idea.
I'd love to get them all in a... Again, they've done movies like this before.
Sure.
Like, they've gathered three or four of them.
But I'm talking about, like, actually Tony Todd and Robert Englund in a movie. Like, they're an old school team. Mm-hmm. They've been working for many, many years fighting various monsters. Mm-hmm. And they're either playing their characters if they can get the rights, or they're playing thinly veiled versions of their characters if they can't.
I'd love to see them gathered in a spot where all of them are the victims.
And there's
some killer stalking all of them.
That could be fun. Knives Out with just horror, casts. That's a fun idea.
Yeah, there you go.
If we want to do like an Avengers bit, I was thinking about this because I've thought about this before because I'm a nerd. I would love to see here's my ideal like horror Avengers based on actual like movie icons. You get Ash from the Evil Dead movies.
All right.
You get Herbert West the Reanimator as their science guy. Okay. You get Hannibal Lecter as like.
It's the face wild
man.
Card. Yeah.
No, he's face man. Oh. he's the one with all the personality. He's the one who's slick and smooth and can get them into anywhere. You've got Elise from the Insidious movies, but she's like the ghost version of Elise.
Okay.
It's from like the ones that they still haven't made. They refused.
The Lin Shaye character.
Yeah. And here's the wild card.
Well, no, you got to get Malignant in there now.
I suppose you do. We'll save that for season two or something. but here's what you do. Here's your wild card. Because they found a way to control him, but it's not reliable. Jason Voorhees.
Kane Hodder, but Jason.
Jason Voorhees is actually like, you know, they can like aim him in a direction or something like that. But if they're not careful, he will run amok and kill everybody. So they have to be very, it's the zombie version of, that would be fun for me. I would love that. But yeah, Gabriel from Malignant. Would be fucking awesome. That's a great pick. I like that a lot.
What was the main character's name?
Cassie? Everyone remembers Gabriel, but no one remembers...
Because she had two names. That was the confusing
part. Poor Annabelle Wallace.
The character played by Annabelle Wallace.
Who was also in the movie Annabelle.
Confusingly enough.
It was weird. Madison.
Madison.
She played Madison. Yeah.
So Madison is there like as part of the team, but her superpower is Gabriel, and she doesn't want to let him out. That's like the Hulk sort of
thing. Well, at the end of the movie, I don't want to get into a huge bunch of spoilers. We're already talking spoilers, actually, but the end of Malignant's so fucking good.
Malignant is a blast, man.
I love Malignant so much. It goes where you think it's going to go, but it doesn't go there the way you thought, and it completely changes genres for like a huge fucking sequence, and you're just like, I did not think we were going here. Thank you for going here. You're the best. James Wan, operating on another level right now.
I would stage a double feature of Malignant and Maniac Cop 2.
Yeah, that's a good one. Hmm. That's a good one. Yeah, I'm down.
They both have the police station slaughter.
Is there any other movie where the protagonist having a bad wig is actually like a plot point? Because I remember watching Malignant and saying like, oh man, her wig is not great. If I recognize a bad wig... Because I'm really bad at recognizing wigs. You know it's a bad wig. But I remember thinking to myself, oh, it was never supposed to be a good wig. Like, it was, there's a reason it's like that.
There's a reason
like,
her hair looks that
way. Yeah, and it's all like, ah, if only there were more movies where bad hair was in... was actually a plot point. Not because, like, the hair is haunted, but, like, yeah. Anyway.
Well, I'm going to assemble a superhero team. What are they going to do? I don't know. I just want them all in the same room together for fun.
Yeah, why not? You know?
I would love to see something like that, but have it be, like, a walk and talk.
Yeah.
Or, you know, My Dinner with Andre scenario. Yeah. Where they just sort of, camera pans around a table and they just have a conversation.
How about all the comedy sidekick characters from various movies throughout the years? Mm. You know? You get, like, Jay and Silent Bob are in there, but
I've seen a bumper like that on Cartoon Network where they had all of the sidekick characters. It was Morocco Mole and Robin.
That's a good one.
Yeah, we didn't have the main stories, but we didn't have all the character personality, but we helped move the story along. And they pan over to Chicken of Cow and Chicken.
Oh yeah,
because that was the hot new show at the time.
Yeah,
he's like, look, I'm not a sidekick. I'm a co-star. My name is in the title.
Sure. You're second.
Yeah, and they just sort of like look askance at, you're not supposed to say that.
Anyway, that is it for We've Got Mail this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We think you're awesome. If you wrote in, we really appreciate it. If we didn't get to your email, we apologize. Feel free to try again. If you want to send us an email that's like super timely, like you want us to read something for someone's birthday, that happens. Make sure you also reach out to us on Twitter so we can make a note of it. We're on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
Whitney is typically in charge of the emails, so he's the one to reach out to in that case. But if you want to write in, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And again, we have a P.O. box, which is?
It's Critically Acclaimed Networks, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Thank you to everybody who wrote in. Thank you, everybody who just listens in. We're very, very grateful to you. Very big special shout out to our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. If you haven't signed up yet and you can afford to do so, we'd love to have you. We have a lot of exclusive shows there. Shows about Batman, Star Trek, the Academy Awards. We do commentary tracks. We do a digital hangout once a month. You can get to vote for future episodes. There's a lot of stuff over there. We hope you enjoy it. I guess that's it. Okay. Well,
sincerely yours.
Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney, I guess. Yeah. Bye.